Hello, and welcome to Small Talk, a podcast from Contemporary Pediatrics. I'm Miranda Hester, and this is the second episode of our series on atypical anorexia. I am once again speaking with Dr. Erin Harrop, who is an assistant professor at the University of Denver and a licensed medical social worker. In this episode, we discuss using a multidisciplinary approach for diagnosis.
Okay, so with most conditions like asthma, there isn't a presumption that every case is going to follow the same path and have the same symptoms. Why doesn't this seem to be true of many eating disorders, and in particular, anorexia?
I think that the stereotypes for eating disorders are very ingrained in our cultural consciousness. And if you think about the times where you see anorexia, or any eating disorder really, reflected in media, we picture very similar things. So like if I were to tell you right now, picture a patient with an eating disorder, you would likely think of a young, white, thin adolescent girl. You might picture her with a plate of food in front of her with like a pea on it or a carrot. You might picture her like huddled in a corner with her head on her knees crying. You might picture somebody who is obviously, quote, too thin, running, in some kind of outfit. But you're probably picturing somebody white. You're probably picturing a female. Or a more feminine presenting individual. And you're probably picturing someone fairly young, kind of adolescent and young 20s. So I think that cultural narrative is really strong. And often that's who is getting treatment more frequently, but it's not who has eating disorders more. And so we have to think about just like the stereotypes that we have and how it does not fit the narrative that we have. If I were to ask you to think of somebody who has binge eating disorder, you would likely think of someone in a fat body, and you might picture them surrounded by junk food and eating in an uncontrollable way. And the truth of the matter is that people in all body types and all body sizes can experience binge eating disorder. Another thing that we don't account for is that restriction is almost always a part of a binge process. And so when we picture binge eating disorder, we often think of just somebody consuming lots and lots of food and then being in a fat body. And then we kind of blame a person's body and their behaviors on their weight. Like we say, like, okay, like this person is binging because they're fat, or they're fat because they're binging. Failing to take into account that there are lots of people who are fat who eat very normally. And there are lots of people who are very fat who eat very restrictively and may have anorexia. And so I think so often it's our stereotypes and our expectations that keep us from seeing the actual behaviors and the mental health of the individuals that we're trying to help.
Okay, so what are some best practices that pediatric clinicians should use when considering a diagnosis of atypical anorexia?
I think so for our pediatricians, we know that people who experience puberty earlier are at greater risk. Obviously, we also know it affects people of all genders. People who are trans, non-binary, gender non-conforming tend to experience eating disorders at higher rates, up to twice as common as young girls that have it. So really keeping some of those risk factors on your kind of like forefront of your mind, that if you're talking to somebody, and that we also see this with queer children as well. So if you have somebody who's presenting with some gender and sexual orientation, identity type things early, we should be looking especially at them. We also shouldn't be approximating health with weight. And I think this is a good practice for anybody. We don't want to assume that our children who are in what we call ideal weight bodies or ideal BMI, we don't want to assume that they fail to have an eating disorder or disordered eating just because they're presenting, quote, very healthy. So we need to be looking for it and asking the questions. And similarly, just because a child is in a higher weight body, we shouldn't assume that they're eating too much. In general, I suggest that we always ask questions about behavior before making assumptions. So when you have a heavy child, when you have a child who is, quote, too thin, we should be asking, hey, what does eating look like? You know, what does food look like? With children, it's very easy for them to make black and white thinking and those kind of decisions. So in general, if we should avoid talking about food as good or bad. We should avoid moralizing a child's food because that definitely goes along with an eating disorder. So even it's some a behavior that you're trying to discourage, like sugary beverages, not moralizing that sugary beverage, making space for all foods within a person's diet is really important. And along those lines, I would say also making space for all cultural traditions. So often we assume kind of a white person metric of food and health. And we have a tendency as providers to attribute unhealthiness to some cultures and some ways of eating. And so making space for food to be not just gas in a car. Calories in, calories out, but for food to be an emotional experience, an embodied experience, a cultural experience, a social experience where you're connecting with family, friends, and loved ones. I really think that helps food kind of take its rightful place in someone's life as opposed to being over or undervalued. In terms of children, I think it's really important to pay attention to that growth curve. Now, I am not a pediatrician myself. I am a medical social worker. And so, you know, take this as just like my suspicions, but paying attention to when, you know, if a child is losing weight, we should know why. What are they doing? You know, if we're seeing weight loss when in childhood and adolescence, we expect growth. Like we should be paying attention if there's that weight loss component. And we should also pay attention if a kid is staying the same, as opposed to growing. You know, if they are, maybe we expect them to be growing more than they are, and that's not happening. And again, approaching these things not in a way of like, you're bad, your body's bad, we need to fix it, but like, oh, like, you know, my son recently this past year did not, experience any, you know, any upward increase in his weight, but he did gain in height. And so there was like this little like flag of a conversation with his pediatrician of like, this is interesting. He's grown this many inches, but his weight has stayed the same. Now I don't want to automatically problematize that because kids do grow at different intervals. But I'm curious about it, right? And for me as a parent to experience my child's weight is like, okay, like I've noticed this thing, but not problematizing it so that I'm trying to like force feed him or force exercise him, right? So that there can be kind of an ease around it. I think in general, not having conversations about a child's weight in front of the child is really useful. And not having conversations, about like that are moralizing food in front of the child. You can give a parent good ideas about dietetics and those kind of things to make sure that a child is getting everything they need. But the child doesn't necessarily need to hear all of that if they are kind of at risk of internalizing that too much. Similarly, like weighing a minimum and doing blind weights just for everybody, I think is good practice. When kids are starting to get into their teen years, allowing them to say like, I prefer not to be weighed today at my exam. Unless there's a really specific reason that you're concerned. And then of course, being affirming of children's bodies. as I think as medical professionals, we spend so much time like looking for problems, that kids can miss the fact that like their body is amazing and their metabolism is amazing and they can do wonderful things. So I think the more that we affirm our clients and their bodies, the more likely they are to want to engage in exercise, to have some of these healthy habits. So often, many of the fatter folks that I interview with eating disorders were discouraged from exercise really early on. They were told that their bodies were not strong, that they weren't athletic, and they internalized those messages so differently from people who were thin children. And so, just really taking time to affirm their body, like, this is great that you have so much power. Like, I could see you being really good at X, Y, or Z. How do you enjoy your body? What things do you enjoy your body when you do? And really spending some of that time on that affirmation as opposed to just the problems that a child may have. And then of course, with eating disorders, numbers are triggering. So, avoiding giving ideal weights, avoiding saying, oh, we think you're going to be weigh this much as an adult, right? Like we don't know. And so making space for what we don't know so that we don't set children up for expectations that don't happen.
Okay, so are there any medical professionals or specialties that you have found are more likely to consider anorexia when faced with an atypical presentation than others?
Not across the board, no. I think in general, our folks in adolescent medicine are a little bit more savvy with eating disorders. But I have not found necessarily that we're even in adolescent medicine, necessarily like kind of on our toes and like ready for what it looks like. I think it often gets not looked at, especially when we're thinking of like endocrine issues. So I see lots of like places where we could catch it. Let me do that instead. Places where we could catch it could be someplace like adolescent medicine. It could be someplace like sports medicine when we're looking at injuries and we're not just excusing an injury because of growth trajectory and growth plates and stuff, but we're actually looking for it. We could also potentially find these cases with people who are coming and presenting for emergency care. People who have experienced fainting, blood in their vomit. You might even see like very low blood pressure. If we're checking for things like orthostatic blood pressure, that change, that can be a way that we can catch folks. In addition to like sports clinics, I would also say some of the kind of the digestive GI discomfort type things. Like sometimes we'll see that gastroparesis where it takes a long time and people are going through a lot of discomfort. And sometimes we might blame it on them being higher weight. We might blame it on them kind of like internalizing too many emotions. But really taking the time to check those things instead of just making assumptions.
Okay, so who should be included in a who should be included in a multidisciplinary team to help treat patients who are presenting with atypical anorexia? And how could a multidisciplinary team improve outcomes for those patients?
So right now we don't have gold standards of care for atypical anorexia that are empirically based. What we have are standards of care that are based mostly on what we call expert opinion, which is, people who have the most experience dealing with these cases and what seems to have worked in their experience. And one of the when talking about what we call atypical disorders, these are also considered kind of residual cases, cases that don't fit a perfect cookie cutter of what a certain eating disorder is supposed to look like. What we say is that we try and treat them according to the standards of care for the disorder that they most closely resemble. So for atypical anorexia folks, that is usually presumed to be typical anorexia. And with typical anorexia, we're generally talking about multidisciplinary teams. So we're talking about a dietitian on the team who can handle all things food related, for the most part, if the person is medically stable. We're talking about a therapist who can handle the kind of individual psychotherapy that is needed by the patient. And in pediatrics, we're also talking about the family. So we are talking about the role that parents and caregivers fill on that team. And I would say, especially for atypical anorexia and anorexia, actually both, like one of the leading treatments that we have for children and adolescents, and even it's also being used with some young adults as well, is called family-based therapy, which is kind of a therapy in which the refeeding and the kind of burden of helping prepare meals and make food and feed the child is placed in the parent's hands, and the patient takes a more passive role. And the parents do all of that. Now, this doesn't work with every family and it doesn't work with every situation, but having parents on board and able to have that active role in their child's recovery is going to be really critical. We also recommend a physician because we need to be monitoring. So I just completed a systematic review of some of the medical literature on atypical anorexia. I'm working on getting it submitted for publication, so hopefully that will be out soon. But I looked at studies that compared the medical outcomes of typical and atypical patients. And in general, for those like life-threatening conditions that people with anorexia get. So looking at electrolyte imbalance, looking at low heart rate, looking at low blood pressure and orthostatic blood pressure, and kind of other like life-threatening situations that happen for people with anorexia. Those happen about the same for typical and atypical presenting patients. So there are some of those that happen slightly more in typical. There are some of those that happen slightly more in atypical, depending on which data set you're looking at. But in general, those life-threatening conditions are going to be the same. And that, I think, is something that many physicians don't think about or realize. Because we assume that if a person was having a life-threatening eating disorder, they would be presenting in a thin body, and that's simply not the case. So having that physician on team is really important. Oftentimes, you might also need to involve someone from like sports medicine if you are dealing with a serious athlete or a high-performance athlete. And you may need to be including other specialties. There's a big overlap with our folks with diabetes and some other mental health characteristics. So keeping kind of whatever specialty care your child needs is also likely needs to be in the loop. I'd also add that right now we don't have elements of eating disorder therapy that are specifically geared towards weight stigma and towards helping patients cope. And I think with atypical anorexia, especially, you have an eating disorder that's super concerned with fat and weight loss. And then you have somebody who may have been in a fat body at some point in their lives who have experienced weight stigma. And they may be afraid of like, what happens if my body grows and I experience weight stigma again or weight stigma more? And I think right now, our eating disorder treatment protocols are not equipped to help with that specific problem that people in larger bodies face in eating disorder recovery, because often we are asking them to recover into a body that will be more stigmatized, as opposed to recovering into a body that people affirm as beautiful and ideal and wonderful. And isn't it so great that you have beat this eating disorder, blah, blah, blah. And so I think that that is something that's kind of on the horizon for atypical anorexia, is that we will need supports around how do we help people nourish and respect their bodies when they recover into bodies that are stigmatized by our society. And so again, right now we don't have a person who does that, but I think treatment programs that take that into account, therapists that have training in weight stigma, all of those are things that are going to be really important for somebody who's dealing with atypical anorexia.
Thanks for listening. If you like us, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.